All right, gentlemen, I don't know if we're all here or not, but we'll kind of get started fairly soon here. The keeping score at home, I've got a few changes of schedule. They want us to have supper closer to 5. I guess they've got another group coming in. So we're going to have supper closer to 5. So we're going to make some adjustments, and we're going to have Vespers at 4. So that'll give us some flex time there. So our final session of the afternoon goes till 3:45. We'll have Vespers at 4, and until Vespers is completed, and then we'll have supper at 5. Nothing major in the way of changes. So, this morning, we're going to try and keep the schedule as you have it there. So this session will go to roughly 10:30, and then we'll come back at 11 until just before noon. All right. Our speaker has arrived, and he has shown... John has shown a level of commitment to get him here in the middle of a very difficult day yesterday. So we're thankful that I saw him here safely and that he is in fact here. He's had a long day and he had early morning this morning, but we're thankful that that you can be here. So I'll let John introduce himself. So.
Yeah. Well, good morning. I'm really very, very, very happy to
has fancy Greek word that's attached to it, anglicized Greek word, and that word is comes from, anybody know the Greek word for midwife? Oh, when I was born, actually, there was a midwife there, not a physician. In Montego Bay, Jamaica, the Greek word for midwife is what this word is based on. It's the maieutic method of even instruction, and it comes from the word which means midwifery or midwife, and it involves more of a dialogical Socratic method. It actually comes from Socrates, and the posing of questions through teaching made it very catechetical, right? Where you ask the right question, and then you follow up with an even more penetrating question, and you kind of, through a series of questions and through a series of conversations, lead the learner, or in this case, the fellow discusser, through a course where you can kind of give birth, is what it is, the midwifery term, give birth to thinking and to kind of creative ideas. So that's a method I'm really hopeful that you guys can be engaging with me on these topics, and I'm gonna actually, I've come to learn. I'm not come to like shower down on you. Okay. I've really come to learn, and as a guide, kind of through this as we go together. The theme that I've chosen is if you saw it advertised or as part of promotional material. By the way, this Michael Keith is amazing. And not only does he have Martin Luther King's initials, which makes him very cool, but what a guy! I mean, just with a great blend of tenacious persistence and evangelical patience and flexibility. And you know, many of us fall off the log on one side or the other on that. But you really keep a good blend so that it doesn't fall off into some kind of legalism on the one hand, which really makes people unhappy, or it doesn't fall off the log into kind of sloppy agape on the other side. So I really like the way you kind of operate on this.
You love how you feel.
So would you like to hear the
reasoning?
Yeah.
You love to
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The
Scottish
part
loves
the embrace. I'm just going real slow until I'm going to have some stuff for you, though. Okay. Especially, I kind of want to look at, you know, what does it mean that as Lutheran people in North America, our ecclesial experience was first in a village church mentality. And now we are compelled to operate and live in a global city modality. That's been the most significant shift, I think, in terms of social trends that have impacted the way we think about ministry and the way we think about preaching. The movement from a time and an era where most people, 200 years ago, never traveled beyond 100 miles from where they were born. At the time of Luther, even fewer people traveled from more than 100 miles from the place of their birth. And now we have this global city. So I actually want to spend some time looking at some dynamics of what that might mean that we're in a global city. And so I want to kind of start more sociologically. We're not going to be talking to that. But just to kind of diagnose the context, do some diagnosis of the context in which we find ourselves as men of the word. And so I've been looking a lot at developing this kind of spectrum of understanding for what it means that you know, we're living in a let's call it a global city. So I want to kind of start here and draw what is
relatively aligned and straight line, and go like this, like this, and just kind of do an analysis. Okay, so first, if I were to say the city, most of my experience in ministry has been in the U.S., 25 years since I moved from Hamilton, and we moved there when I was 4, and I moved away from there when I was 18. So, most of my experience in the U.S. side has been in urban ministry settings, first as a church musician and youth director in Detroit, on the west side of Detroit, while I was in college, and then worked at a church in Buffalo, New York, all the years of seminary, and urban church in Buffalo, and then on to Detroit. And but if I were to say city, what would you think of? I mean, what kind of description would you give of a city? What is a city? What defines a city?
1,000 people.
Something that's not the country. Yeah. That's something that's not the country, yeah.
Well, I said, interesting, in Saskatchewan, a city, I think it's 5,000 people constitutes a city in Saskatchewan.
So
the population, that is correct.
A bunch of people.
But 5,000 people in a contained area?
Yes.
Yes.
And, okay, so how do you define that? Why don't we do that?
I would just say lots of people.
Okay, so you're going to say dense population, okay?
Yes.
So, let's say density is one of the characteristics.
Amenities.
What's that?
Yeah.
Amenities.
Yeah.
Infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Like paved roads.
Hospitals.
Infrastructure.
Yeah. 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 Like,
culture.
Yeah.
Pace of life.
Four ways. All of the 4 million people, but it's not really a city. I mean, in the sense that it doesn't have any near the kind of feel of, I'm trying to think of another city of comparable size. To me, Fort Wayne was a bunch of small neighborhoods that were all just right next to each other.
Well, New York is like that. New York's a bunch of small neighborhoods that are right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, strong Chicago's like that. Strong neighborhood affiliation. But I think you said pace of life first.
So
the
pace
of
Chicago is pace of Fort Wayne.
Yeah, but there's a dynamism still that marks life in the city. And I would argue marks all of life no matter where it is. My premise is that the urbanization of the planet basically is underway. And no matter where you are or where you live, this is going to be my premise, no matter where you are or where you live, you're dealing with a global city. You're dealing with an urbanized environment. You may not have a dense population, but because of media influences, you have a density of information. You have a density of proximity to other people. Because of the internet and because of the media, you're close to people. Okay, so what else? Your sense of social networking. You know, that you have these social, like Facebook and things like that, these social networks. I mean, those things, there's a lot of people involved. That's a density of population. In fact, I've got a person who's a graduate assistant who manages my my Facebook account. Yeah, it's actually true, because I talk at youth gatherings, and you know, and then the kids all want to connect with you after a youth gathering, and then the students want to connect, and it's just impossible, an 8-hour-a-day job to try to manage that density of information and networking of people. So that's going to be my premise, and I hope I mean, we'll just throw it out there, and you guys can say, yeah, it works, it doesn't work. Because then I want to say that if that's true, that we're living in a globalized urban environment, then that then impacts the way we proclaim to that sort of, those variables impact our proclamation. Not the content, which always remains core and the same, but the way it's packed and unpacked is drastically changed. Okay, so we got density of population, and it's not density. Some have defined the city as 1,000 people per square mile.
that's what defines the city. But I'm suggesting that that density of population is now either virtual or real. That people are living in a kind of virtual density. Clearly the density of information, we have information overload. Was it C.S. Eliot who wrote that piece, Where's the Life We Have Lost in Living? Where's the knowledge we have lost in information? Where's the information we have lost in wisdom? No, where's the wisdom we have lost in information? So you have this glut and surfeit of information and of sort of density. And then you also have dynamism, which is, I mean, we're the first culture in the history of the world that stands in front of microwave ovens thinking, there's got to be a faster way than this. That's crazy. That's insane. We're the first that, you know, they can't wait to get our new computer because it's faster. Because in milliseconds of more quickness, we'll be able to connect with people on the other side of the planet. Think about that. Because it takes too long to connect with the guy in Shanghai. So we want something faster. Think about how insane that is. So there's a kind of a dynamism that marks all of life, no matter where you are. What else? The city. And the third dynamic I really want to...
He's following with your D word threat with diversity.
That's exactly the word I have there.
Mm-hmm.
You see it when I come in. I need a D word. I like that kind of stuff. You know, alliteration and the tricks that get you through seminary and stuff.
Yeah. In fact, one of the sessions we're going to have are
my nitpicky acrostics. Well, going up with acrostics. So I've got a bunch of acrostics we're going to kind of look at. It's a lot of fun, I think.
That's an evening session. Density, dynamism, and diversity. So, what do you mean by diversity then?
The people there that represent the city come from many different ethnic, cultural backgrounds.
That's exactly right. So, density, media-induced, internet-driven, peopled space, dynamism, energy, change.
Things don't stay the same. They change, no matter where you live now.
And then diversity, which changes everything.
I was in Turku. Who serves Finnish people? Who was that guy last night? Oh, you didn't have the Finns. Yeah, I was in Turku, which is on the western edge of Finland. Turku. Last year, and was amazed at the Somalian population.
Really?
Yeah, really. I mean, Helsinki you'd expect it in a kind of world city, but Turku, this little hamlet on the western edge of Finland. In Davenport, Iowa, they've got a resolution, or they had a resolution last year before the city council, about who would be permitted to run their local marathon. Because there were too many Kenyans winning the Davenport. So they actually had a resolution at city council that you had to establish some kind of residency before you could run in their marathon. One of the things, here's some Canadian content. One of the things I really prize about my own background is the kind of diverse environment we grew up in the Golden Shoe. Where, you know, my friends had last names from around the globe, and most of their parents could not speak English. They were first-generation Canadians, Italians and Japanese and Portuguese and Greek. A lot of Europeans, Caribbean, people from the West Indies, a little bit of everybody was in that kind of environment. No matter what you say about Pierre Elliott Trudeau, he did open up Canada, and it really has become maybe the first country in the history of the world that is represented by all of the countries from around the world, even more so than the U.S. in many ways. That became real to me when I went to Concordia Ann Arbor in 1981, and one of the first things they did was they gave me the census data to fill out. We had to check all of these boxes. This is all under the item diversity item there. And the first box they had was black.
you heard about his mother, who was African-based in Cushy. So I checked that box. And Nick Box was white. My mother is Scottish and German. And
he just wants to be
Fisher on one side and Haldane. And so I checked that box. And the next category was Spanish surname. Well, my last name is Emanuel, which is Portuguese. Were it to have a Z on the end, it would be Spanish. And we don't know how we got the name. We like to say it was some pirate of the Caribbean. It was a swashbuckling buccaneer who was probably more of a deckhand or a rogue who left offspring and left a name. So I thought, well, Portugal, pretty close to Spain, so I got that box. And then the next category was international student, born in Jamaica, has lived in Canada, and moved to the U.S. That's three countries. That's how that counts. So I checked that. A day later, this guy with a bow tie was obviously tied to Tyree. Very, very meticulous. I mean, like details, but no, details, we adore you, we worship you, we love you, we love details, right? And Timothy said, no, this won't do. You can't be all these things. It's impossible for you to be all these things. We need to be one thing. So I said, it was a sad day. You know what? I mean, okay, but God's child love is on the box. You know, chosen race, holy nation, royal priesthood, none of that was on the box for me to check. You know, he had all these other categories. And so I, and he had to be one thing. None of them were kind of God's thing. You know, weird. So I remember, like, okay, if that's what you mean by that, then I'll be black then, if that's what you want. So I actually started the Black Students Organization on campus, and my first activity was to lead a walkout on Martin Luther King Day, because in those days, they didn't really have any kind of recognition of King. I thought it mattered, college campus, a place where there's learning happening, that we ought to do that. So I think they regretted the fact that they worked black box. But we're living in a time with just incredible diversity that you can't put people, no matter who they are anymore, in any sort of box. In the village church environment, you could. You kind of knew who a person was. You knew who his parents were. You knew who his kinfolk were. You knew what the family traditions were. You knew what church they went to. You knew how to troll your altar. And now, if, as you well know, no matter where you are, becoming increasingly complexified. Because you can't anymore ask the question, well, listen, you gotta be careful when you ask the question. But you gotta ask yourself the question, who do we mean when we say we? So, when we say we, do we mean those who believe, teach, and confess the faith that we hold? I still hear, you know, talk in churches like when our forefathers first came over from, well, who are you talking about? You're talking about me. On either side of my family, I'm not included. They weren't on, what is it, the Nina, Santa Maria, and Pinta, whatever those three ships were. One of the thumbs or something. I mean, it's too bad. I'm not
that. Amelia.
Yeah. They came up the Mississippi River or whatever, and I mean, we weren't in that wave of Saxons and Bavarians, no matter what. So who do we mean when we say we? We have to be careful when we use language now, like this language of we. And I'm thinking, you can't presume who the other is any longer. You can't presume you've got people figured out. You can't presume that just because they're Lutheran Church Canada, they understand the essentials of the faith. Those presumptions, those facile presumptions, are no longer possible. There, I think there was a time when you could presume that to be a thing meant a certain thing. But you can't presume that anymore, which has left us with two options. And essentially, these are two options I've seen, and maybe there needs to be a third way.
first option I've seen in the midst of all of this diversity and density of population and dynamism. It is what? What would be an option?
Embrace it.
Yeah, to embrace it, to overwhelmingly embrace it. And to embrace it uncritically. To load up on it. Yeah, and we're actually going to look at faith culture and see how they relate to each other. It's one of my projects, LOAD. How faith and culture relate to each other. Because, you're right, that could be one of the things that people do, is they embrace it without critique. But I see among our circles a more pervasive trend. Especially I've seen it in the last 30 years. From the time when my family joined the Lutheran Church. Not because we weren't. Because we were born Lutheran. Okay. I thought you were born a sinner. Baptized into the Lutheran Church as an infant, maybe. I was baptized in a Methodist church, and in Jamaica. This first session, they would let you know that it's who I am, and. My parents moved to Hamilton, and my mother had two sons. You might not believe this, but we were very active, overactive. I mean, we were, before they had diagnosed with ADHD, we were it. And she found four-letter diagnosis, a three-letter summer solution. BBS. And so we weren't Lutherans, and she found that Lutheran Church was having a BBS at 1054 Upper Sherman Avenue, Pilgrim Church, Hamilton. And so she took us down there, and by 9:45, this mean pastor's wife, for no reason at all, had my brother and I by the scruff of our necks, Minnesota born and farm born and bred. And dragging us home for fighting each other. And and we got to the door, and I get my mother embarrassed us by letting out this big scream. They're back! and began to cry, I guess. And the pastor's wife said words that have played like a tape loop in my mind ever since. She said, "Well, we'll take them back. We're the Lutheran Church. We're the Church of Second Chance." And then she grabbed us even tighter. That was the law, tangibly applied. Dragged us back to the vacation Bible school and compelled us to behave. And probably gave us a third chance and a fourth chance and a fifth chance. By Friday, when Lutheran churches used to have these programs, where you invite everybody out on a Friday night from the community and have like a, not a service, of course, but it's a community kind of, get together, sing some songs and do a little, and I'll never forget, I was the acolyte that night. I mean, I was so happy to be there. So we say, we joined Lutheran Church from the fight to the acolyte. That was the way we joined. This guy was amazing because he was just rock solid when it came to confessing the faith. Unswerving. Who Jesus Christ was, but yet equally unrelentingly evangelical in his concern for people and in his embrace of people and in his intentionality about reaching communities that were not like his own. So in our congregation, we have people from literally around the world. We have people from Hong Kong who have been actually Lutheran in Hong Kong, from international schools, and the work over there. We had Guyanese Lutherans, where there were Dutch who went to the Caribbean 400 years ago and planted Lutheran churches in places like Christian said. We had people from everywhere in this congregation. He was intentional about cultivating this community. And frankly, that's the way I thought the Lutheran church was. I thought this is what it means to be Lutheran. It means to be Lutheran means that worship supplement. He had the little guy seated and the little guy standing.
I love it.
The Holy Eucharist.
Yeah.
And the,
I loved it.
It was so cool.
You knew it.
Exactly what to do.
Right?
Yeah.
Not like a little triangle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 Right. Yeah. And it worked itself in. We sang it. We used that thing, and then and this guy was just an amazing guy. That's why out of that parish we had within the span of 5 or 6 years, 9 or 10 church workers. And, Kevin Bass was in my confirmation class, and Warren Hanson was in my confirmation class. David Ham was like a year or two ahead of us. And my sister, Brenna, is a deaconess in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Marie Hartley, I think her last name was, is a school teacher somewhere. And Paul Kaler is a school teacher. And John Kaler was in my confirmation class as a school teacher. And this goes on and on and on in terms of the degree of influence. But I think he was onto something there at a time before fear crept in. You see, it was just this moment, this kind of open moment before fear crept in and a recoiling crept in and a retreat crept in as a way of dealing with difference, as a way of dealing with diversity, and as a way of dealing with the dynamism that's overwhelming for us. I think it's become so overwhelming for us that a pattern is to become characteristically now un-Lutheran. The Christ culture paradigm is very, very interesting. Anybody know H. Richard Niebuhr?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he's got the five apologists, and they suck typically. Because he loads up categories so that he loads up the categories so that he wins in the end. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you write a paper, a comparative religion paper, you know, and you're comparing, you know, Elkanah's doctrine and, like, ELCSC doctrine. You load it up. I mean, it's easy to win. So you load it up, and you set it up, and you win. Okay? So that's what Niebuhr basically does in his five typologies. If he sets it up and he designs it so that the Christ as the transformer of culture wins in the end, which is false. As a way of understanding our relationship to the culture. Now, the second falsity about Niebuhr is that his categories are binary, only one or the other. Does anybody remember where he puts Lutherans in that?
The fourth one.
That's exactly right. Very good. In the fourth one, which is Christ and culture in paradox. Now, we're not just stuck in that fourth one, which is what people might try to do to us, Niebuhr tried to do to us. We're not just stuck in it, but that category is very important and is really more typical of the way Lutherans had historically related to the world. I think until this new thing happened, with this globalization, urbanization, postmodernism, you can call it whatever you want to. You can call it whatever you want to. And none of the terms kind of capture all of it. We know what it is, though. It's kind of like jazz, right? Well, can you define it? No, but I know it when I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, preaching the gospel, kind of. Mm-hmm. It's hard to kind of capture it. I mean, you know when you've heard the gospel of Jesus Christ preached. Okay, it's kind of like that. And so, whatever this thing is, we have typically, and I think sadly, disengaged from the world, and I believe taken an Anabaptist strategy in relating to the world. That is the reserve category, Christ against culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we now define ourselves almost exclusively by what we are not.
Mm-hmm.
Not by what we are, not what we believe, teach, and confess, which are very active verbs. In faith for Luther, the active thing of daring, living, joyful, trust in God's grace.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what faith is. The confession of faith, to speak together our faith, is a very active thing, as is the teaching. But we've taken a more defensive modality in response to this stuff, so that you hear from us, and it's a strange thing. You hear people saying weird stuff, like, have access to an opportunity to read, to write. In her life, no running water, no.
But she was not.
Well, that's easy for you to say.
Yeah.
But she was faithful.
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You know, it's easy when you have infrastructure to say infrastructure.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's easy when you kind of have infrastructure to say, well, you know, there's this kind of.
They had a simple faith. You know, the myth of the noble savage. You know.
They had a simple faith. They had a good faith. It was pure faith. They didn't have any running water or electricity, and they had no way to get rid of the cancer that was in them, or to get rid of the rotten teeth. But they were
no medicine, you know, and no. But they were.
There's something about that that is. You know, I don't know. I'm not buying it. Things worked better for my parents 50 years ago in an interracial American over by 50, 45 years ago when they got married. So much so that when they decided to move from Jamaica, they're trying to find a place to raise their children where their children would have an opportunity that they didn't have. They could not move to the U.S. because of the kind of climate there was when all our family lived in New Jersey and in New York. But we couldn't move there because we had this special circumstance. Better for whom? You know, I think you can ask that question of a lot of communities, you know, for whom and better. So we've got to be very careful again with these questions, these fast off presumptions, like, who do we mean when we speak? And, you know, things are better for who? Okay, so the pattern I want to kind of get at is, I want to kind of do a kind of not an attack, but a critique of this recoiling I'm saying there. Does anyone want to
Larry, right?
Excuse me?
Larry.
Yeah.
David, actually.
David, yes.
That's my
first name. Yeah, I wasn't good. I was I had a student whose name was Donald, but to me he looked like Gordon. and I would call him Gordon, and then finally he started answering. The scary part was once I said Gordon, and he started.
I have a pretty monocultural setting.
Yeah.
Fair.
You think so?
So I mean, much more than typical. I mean, Fairview, Montana. Sure. It's not completely, but I mean, comparatively.
Yeah.
But what I was hearing as you were talking was. You talk about this pastor in Minnesota who's, you know, bemoaning the moral decay and the decline of the family. And we've got that. Mm-hmm. And that, I have all of the 25 to 40 year old members who have kids whose family life is just, you know, in immorality 50 years ago, it's just been a complete failure.
Yeah.
And I get their kids once in a while. I had one in the church sometimes, which was just, I hadn't seen her. And they don't, that you can't make assumptions thing, I think, applies very directly there, because, you know, they, for whatever reason, are not their parents' children in terms of the way they live, or maybe they are and their parents were good at hiding it, I don't know. But I mean, outwardly, they just haven't measured up.
Well, that's very well.
And they are incredibly hard to connect with, because they are afraid of many things that he didn't even represent.
That's right.
So I mean, even in Montana, the same kind of, because of the media and the connections and everything that influences everybody, I think they have much the same context, even though on the surface of it.
That's a very good analysis, David. That's a very good analysis. I agree with you. And I used to think that when I first pastored in Detroit, I guess pastored in when I was a pastor in Detroit, I was like, well, these African American families are the most screwed up families that I've ever seen in my life. And the degree of dysfunction. They were in Dallas for a while, and I worked with them. We had a lot of Hispanic. Oh, by the way, you know what's on a little church, because I think that it's important for people who are either teaching full-time or behaving administratively full-time to find a way to connect themselves regularly with local faith communities where, I don't say the rubber hits the road, the rubber hits the pothole.
Yeah.
And where pew and altar and pulpit and font kind of juxtapose against, because that's primary theology. Everything else is supportive or secondary theology. What happens in on Sunday morning. So I took this little church and it was 12 people. You know, average age 9,800. and all white and English speaking. And they have the most screwed up families I've ever seen in my life. So there's something pervasive about this thing called sin.
Yeah.
you're taking notes. what is it? Richard John Newhouse said original sin is the only doctrine that requires no biblical proof. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Did you take 10:30?
Give or take, yep.
Okay. It's taken already.
Okay.
Did you want
to? Really quick question. You said the first struggle of Christ against culture, and we're defining ourselves against who we want, right? You're saying there are
I don't know. There's been a move. I think there's a move that's been in reaction to some of these forces.
I guess my question for you is, when you look at that and you sense that more with clergy?
Hmm.
Or with laity?
Yeah, Jesus. Hmm. That's not a great question. I guess I'm not gonna fall for that, right? I'm not put anybody in any box either, you know.
No.
I don't think we're okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Here's what I sense it generationally.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
That's where I primarily sense it. I don't sense this primarily clergy based, but in terms of generationally. And so we all know what I mean by that. You know, some of these younger guys that are kind of my age or younger, I'm definitely at a precipice somehow. So the guys that are like, I'm 44, so the guys my age and younger often are the guys who are kind of reacting strongly against a world that they feel spun too fast for them to get their minds around. And then a lot of guys who are older, some of the older kind of guys are now, I don't think they're reactive. I'm not sure if it's that easily divisible either, instead of one side, instead of the other, divisible into one side or the other. That's a good point, though. And I wonder where it prevails more. Where it doesn't prevail, I don't know.
Any other comments from you?
Yeah, I'm sorry, your name again?
Gary.
You're the one who got me in last night. I'm going to talk about Western male pathology.
Exactly.
You guys are laughing too much. Go ahead.
Yep.
Okay, then we'll go to 11, and when we come back to 11, we're going to look.